तुंजा बिहारी जसोद नंदना ब्रज जनारंजना जसोद नंदना ब्रज जनारंजना जामुन तिरवन चारी नतिरवन जामुन तिरवन चारी जा राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी गुंजाबिहारी गोपी जन बालक गिरिवर धारी जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज कुशलय शतरुचतुषी श्रीमारि सुवांगे श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय गंधराज में भावतम की जय गौर प्रेमनंदी ऑल ग्लोरीज टू दिस सुंदर बॉडीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री श्री गुरु गौरांग ओम ज्ञानतमिनंदश रनंजन शलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्री गुरुवे नमः श्री चैतन्य मनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं नृपकदामयं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यरेव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Chapter 4, the Hamsa Guhya Prayers Offered to the Lord by Prajapati Daksha. There's an introduction, so we'll read that now. Introduction by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. After Maharaj Parikshit appealed to Shukadeva Goswami to describe in further detail the creation of the living entities within this universe, Shukadeva Goswami informed him that when the Prachetas, the 10 sons of Prachinabharhi, entered the sea to execute austerities, the planet Earth was neglected because of the absence of a king. Naturally, many weeds and unnecessary trees grew, and no food grains were produced. Indeed, all the land became like a forest. When the 10 Prachetas came out of the sea and saw the entire world full of trees, they were very angry with the trees and decided to destroy them, all to rectify the situation. Thus, the Prachetas created wind and fire to burn the trees to ashes. Soma, however, the king of the moon and the king of all vegetation, forbade the Prachetas to destroy the trees, since the trees are the source of fruit and flowers for all living beings. Just to satisfy the Prachetas, Soma gave them a beautiful girl born of Pramlocha Apsara. By the semen of all the Prachetas, Daksha was born of that girl. In the beginning, Daksha created all the demigods, demons, and human beings, but when he found the population not increasing properly, he took sannyas and went to Vindhya Mountains, where he underwent severe austerities and offered Lord Vishnu a particular prayer, known as Hamsa Guhya, to which Lord Vishnu became very pleased with him. The contents of the prayer were as follows. So this is Daksha praying to Lord Vishnu. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Super Soul, Lord Hari, is the controller of both the living entities and the material nature. He is self-sufficient and self-effulgent. As the subject matter of perception is not the cause of our perceiving senses. So the living entity, although within his body, does not cause his eternal friend, the Super Soul, who is the cause of creation of all the senses. Because of the living entity's ignorance, his senses are engaged with material objects. Since the living entity is alive, he can understand the creation of this material world to some extent, but he cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is beyond the conception of the body, mind, and intelligence. Nevertheless, great sages who are always in meditation can see the personal form of the Lord within their hearts. Since an ordinary living being is materially contaminated, his words and intelligence are also material. Therefore, he cannot ascertain the Supreme Personality of Godhead by manipulating his material senses. The conception of God derived through the material senses is inaccurate because the Supreme Lord is beyond the material senses. But when one engages his senses in devotional service, the eternal Supreme Personality of Godhead is revealed on the platform of the soul. What the Supreme Godhead becomes, when that Supreme Godhead becomes the aim of one's life, one is said to have attained spiritual knowledge. The Supreme Brahman is the cause of all causes because he originally existed before the creation. He is the original cause of everything, both material and spiritual, and his existence is independent. However, the Lord has a potency called avidya, the illusory energy, which induces the false arguer to think himself perfect, and which induces the illusory energy to bewilder the conditioned soul. That Supreme Brahman, the Super Soul, is very affectionate to his devotees. To bestow mercy upon them, he discloses his form, name, attributes, and qualities to be worshipped within this material world. Unfortunately, however, those who are materially absorbed worship various demigods. As the air passes over a lotus flower and carries the scent of the flower with it, or as the air sometimes carries dust and therefore assumes colors, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears as the various demigods according to the desires of his various foolish worshippers. But actually, he is the Supreme Truth, Lord Vishnu. To fulfill the desires of his devotees, he appears in various incarnations, and therefore there is no need to worship the demigods. That's the end of his prayers. In conclusion, being very satisfied by the prayers of Daksha, Lord Vishnu appeared before Daksha with eight arms. The Lord was dressed in yellow garments and had a blackish complexion. Understanding that Daksha was very eager to follow the path of enjoyment, the Lord awarded him the potency to enjoy the illusory energy. That means he was good at sex life. The Lord offered him the daughter of Panchajana named Akshini, who was suitable for Maharaj Daksha to enjoy in sex. Indeed, Daksha received his name because he was very expert in sex life. Daksha means expert, so he's very expert in sex life. After awarding this benediction, Lord Vishnu disappeared. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So that's a summary of the chapter, so we'll go to the first verse. Sri Raja. Okay. Sri Raja Vacha. Devasura Nirnam Sargo. Naganam Rigapakshinam Samasikastoya Prokto Yastu Swayam Bhuventare Ventare Siddhartha Vasa. Naganam Rigapakshinam Samasikastaya Proto
Astu Swayambhu Ventare.
Okay. Tasyaiva Vyasam Ichchami. Natum Te Bhagavan Yata. Anusargam Yaya Shakya. Sasarja Bhagavan Para. Sri Raja Uvacha. The king said, Deva Asura Nirnam. Of the demigods, the demons, and the human beings, Sarga, the creation, Naghanam. Of the Nagas, serpentine living entities, Mrigapakshinam. Of the beast and birds, Samasikaha, briefly, Twaya, by you, Prokta, described, Yaha, which, to, however, Swayambhuve, a Swayambhuva Manu, Antare, within the period, Tasya, of this, Eva, indeed, Vyasam, the detailed account, Ichchami, I wish, Gnatum, to know, Te, from you, Bhagavan, O my Lord, Yata, as well as Anusargham, the subsequent creation, Yaya, by which, Shaktya, potency, Sasarja, created Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Para, transcendental. Translation by Srila Prabhupada Kijai. The blessed king said to Shukadeva Goswami, my dear Lord, the demigods, demons, human beings, nagas, beasts, and birds were created during the reign of Swayambhuva Manu. You have spoken about this creation briefly in the third canto. Now I wish to know about it elaborately. I also wish to know about the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by which he brought about the secondary creation. Okay, so Shukadeva Goswami asking two things here. First thing is that Shukadeva Goswami had discussed in brief about the secondary creation. There are two types of creation. Two types. One is called Sarga, then Visarga. Sarga means creation. Visarga means the subsequent creation, secondary creation. The first type of creation is the ingredients of material existence given by the Supreme Lord, basically. Understand? Supreme Lord gives all the ingredients for material creation. And then the secondary creation refers to Lord Brahma assembling those ingredients and creating the world as we see it today, according to the karmas of the various conditioned jivas. Understand? Two types of creation. So then he's saying that you discussed this in brief in the third canto. I thought Kapila Deva's description was pretty elaborate, but anyway, he's saying here that he discussed it in brief, so he wants to hear about it in more detail. It seems like he's particularly asking in terms of how the universe was populated, because that's what Daksha's kind of duty is. Therefore, he's expert at sex life. So how the universe get populated? That's kind of seems to be the mood, because he's talking about the various types of living entities that manifested from Swayambhuva Manu, who's a son of Brahma. And then, so how, you only talk about this in brief. Can you give in more detail how the subsequent creation kind of got populated? That's question one. And question two, he wants to know about the Shakti, or the potency, by which the Supreme Lord brought about the secondary creation. So two questions. Understand? Two questions. Yeah.
I was wondering, in relationship to the overall theme of this canto, which is Poshanam, do you think the relationship is that the Lord.
We'll get to that. It's coming up. I'll describe that in a minute. Okay, next verse. Shri Sutu Vacha Iti Samprashnam Akarnya Raja Shir Bhadarayani Pratinandhya Mahayogi Jagadha Munisattama. Sudha Goswami said, O great sages assembled at Naimisharanya, after the great yogi Shukadev Goswami heard King Parikshit's inquiry, he praised it and thus replied. Text 4. Shri Shuka Uvacha Yada Prachetasa Putra Disha Prachina Bharhisha Anta Samudrat Unmakna Dadrishur Gam Drumair Vritam. Translation. Shukadeva Goswami said, when the 10 sons of Prachinabarhi emerged from the waters in which they were performing austerities, they saw that the entire surface of the world was covered by trees. Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. When King Prachinabarhi was performing the Vedic rituals in which the killing of animals was recommended, Narada Muni, out of compassion, advised him to stop. Prachinabarhi understood Narada properly and then left the kingdom to perform austerities in the forest. His 10 sons, however, were performing austerities within the water, and therefore there was no king to see to the management of the world. When the 10 sons, the Prachetas, came out of the water, they saw that the earth was overrun with trees. When the government neglects agriculture, which is necessary for the production of food, the land becomes covered with unnecessary trees. Of course, many trees are useful because they produce fruits and flowers, but many other trees are unnecessary. They could be used as fuel and the land cleared and used for agriculture. When the government is negligent, less grain is produced, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 44. Krishi Goraksha Vanigyam Vaishya Karma Swabhavajam. The proper engagements for Vaishyas, according to their nature, are to farm and to protect cows. The duty of the government and the Kshatriyas is to see that the members of the third class, the Vaishyas, who are neither Brahmanas nor Kshatriyas, are thus properly engaged. Kshatriyas are meant to protect human beings, whereas Vaishyas are meant to protect useful animals, especially cows, Srila Prabhupada Ki. Yeah, so going back to the question Himanshu asked about Poshanam. Poshanam means, anyone remembers the potion? Protection from the Lord. Even when the devotees sometimes transgress the laws of Dharma. Understand? Sometimes it happens that the devotees will transgress the laws of religious principles. But because of their devotion to the Supreme Lord, they gain his protection despite that transgression. Understand? So then there are three examples given in the sixth canto. This is the theme of the sixth canto. It's a theme that comes out throughout the Bhagavatam. But the sixth canto is given, the theme is given to the sixth canto, is Poshanam. So three examples are given in the sixth canto. Ajamil's story is the first. So we saw his transgression of religious principles. And yet he was protected by the Lord because of chanting the name of Lord Narayana. And in the second story, we're going to hear about Indra, who killed his guru, Vishwarupa, and how, although that was major transgression, an offense actually, he also received the protection of the Lord. Although he didn't get the full mercy of the Lord, and we'll kind of get to that when we get to the Vitrasura pastime, how he was in some sense cheated by the Lord because he remains in samsara, chasing after sin's gratification. But despite his transgression, he also receives the protection of the Lord. This second story. Third story is Chittaketu. Three stories, understand? Poshana means when you get the protection of the Lord who protects his devotee even when they sometimes transgress the laws of Dharma and morality. So it's a very nice thing, very encouraging thing. The encouragement is to? What is the encouragement? Yeah, take shelter of Krishna. Develop bhakti. So even when there is some mistake, the Lord will protect his devotee. Of course, it doesn't mean the devotee is intentionally making mistakes. Like, I got the protection of the Lord, and you can do whatever you want. But such is the encouragement of the sixth canto, to take shelter of Krishna. Because even by a little bit of bhakti, one can gain the protection of the Lord. That was, we already heard nicely, first three chapters. So, the Indra kills his guru is Vishwarupa. And Vishwarupa is the son of Tvashta. We'll come to learn about this. And Tvashta is the son of Daksha and Aditi. Daksha and Aditi. So now we're going to hear about Daksha, how this storyline is being developed. Understand Daksha, how he eventually marries Aditi, has son Tvashta. Then they have Vishwarupa. Vishwarupa will become the guru for Indra and the Devatas. Indra will kill him later on because of misunderstanding. So this is how the storyline is developing here. Parashit Maharaj is asked to hear about the creation in greater detail. So he heard about it in brief. And the fourth canto, we hear about Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is the first living entity in the universe. From his body, he has two children who happen to be husband and wife. This is the inconceivable nature of material creation. Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. Swayambhuva Manu is a progenitor of mankind. So he has various types of children, living entities. Anyway, amongst the various children he have who are progenitors for populating the universe, he has three daughters and two sons. I don't remember the daughter's name, Akuti Prasuti and Devahuti. So we heard about them in the third canto's fourth canto a little bit. And then in fourth canto, we hear about his son, particularly Uttanapad. Fifth canto, we hear about his other son, Priyavrata. So in the dynasty coming from Uttanapad, are you following? Anyway, all these names get confusing. Yes, Uttanapad is the son of Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. So Uttanapad, he has two sons, Uttanapad, one side, Priyavrata one side, understand? So now we're going to, Uttanapad. Yes, he's born from the body of Lord Brahma, directly from his body, along with his wife, Shatarupa. So I guess she's technically a child also. It's bewildering. Anyway, such is the inconceivable nature of Lord Brahma's subsequent creation. So you have Brahma, then you have Swayambhuva Manu, you have Uttanapad. And in the dynasty of Uttanapad, you have famous personalities like Dhruva Maharaj, and then you scroll down a little bit, and you come to King Prachina Barhisha, who we're hearing about here, who also has sons, the Prachetas. So the Prachetas were sent all to perform austerity for populating the universe by King Prachina Barhisha. So they go to populate the universe. They go and enter into the waters. I forget which land they went to. I didn't research it. Anyway, they go to perform austerities under the water for 10,000 years. Later on, they receive the mercy of the Supreme... Well, they first receive the mercy of Shiva. Shiva teaches them the Rudra Gita. They offer that Rudra Gita to the Supreme Lord for 10,000 years underneath the water. And they please the Supreme Lord, who comes before them. They offer prayers to him. And later on, they will become the kings of the world. And that was told in brief. So now he wants to hear that story in detail. That whole story was told in like, I mean, their prayers were offered. That whole section was told elaborately. But then what happened after they offered prayers to Lord Vishnu was told in like a verse or two. So now Parikshit Maharaj, who has a really good memory, obviously, wants to hear about that particular element in greater detail. So that's where kind of the storyline is picking up here. King Prachina Barhi, he was a great king coming in that line of Uttanapad also. And we heard in the fourth canto how he was attached to the ritualistic formulas of the Vedas, which prescribe animal killing. And he was like really into it. And this was, of course, dangerous because excessive violence towards animals or towards any living entity leads to degradation. So Narada Muni, out of compassion, wanted to preach to him. And that took up four or five chapters of the fourth canto, where Narada Muni preaches to him using the allegory Paranjana and so on. We heard this allegory. I'm not going through all the details here now. This is what we've kind of covered in the previous cantos. So after hearing that allegory, Prachinabarhi left for to perfect his self-realization immediately without waiting for his sons to come back. Which is a little bit interesting because you would think as a king, a responsible king, he would wait to see that someone had properly taken up the reins of the kingdom before he went off for self-realization. There was some discussion in the fourth canto that self-realization is so important that one shouldn't even waste a moment for it. And so in certain circumstances, one may choose to just abandon all sorts of material responsibilities in order to perfect a self-realization. And even if that shall be considered sinful, in the ordinary sense of things, self-realization is so important that even if there is some sin in doing so, the Supreme Lord will purify one of that sin. That verse I already quoted. Svapada mulam bhajata priyasya tyaktanam bhavasya hari paresha. Where this is mentioned in 11th canto, that one who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, taktya anya, abandoning all other such duties, then he is very dear to the Supreme Lord. And even if he does some sinful activity, then the Supreme Lord, who is in his heart, denoti riddhis, what is that? Denoti riddhis anivishta. What is that? I'm forgetting the verse now. No, denoti sarvesham riddhis anivishta. That the Supreme Lord is in his heart, will purify him of all those particular sins. Such is the incontrovertible necessity of self-realization, that one can abandon ordinary responsibilities in order to pursue it. That message came up in relationship to Prachinabarhi. Anyway, as a result of abandoning his duties because of the importance of self-realization, the kingdom was left without a king to rule. So as a result of a proper king not being there, there was some discrepancy in the upkeep of the society, namely here in context. So many useless trees were developed. So many useless trees. A useful tree means one tree that gives fruits and flowers. A useless tree is trees that don't do so. Here, the trees kind of populated the whole entire globe so that there was no room for agriculture. And without there being room for agriculture, how would living entities live? Although in the modern society, we kind of take it that we'll exist off of Dominix and Walmart and so on. You know, milk, if you ask children today, where does milk come from? They might tell you Dean's. Dean's is a type of milk brand and so on. Because there's a great disconnect from nature as a result of our modern way of living. But and even for persons that say we'll survive by eating meat, eating animals and so on, the animals depend on the land for their survival, for their sustenance. So then, in order to even eat meat, you need to have land for animals to graze on and eat and survive and so on. So agriculture is very important for the upkeep of society. In order for agriculture to be successful, you need rain. In order for rain to be successful, you need yajna. All these sorts of things are described in the Bhagavad Gita. So these things were not taking place. As a result, these useless trees populated the universe. There was no room for agriculture. And that way, living entities were actually suffering. Prabhupada in the second paragraph points to the point that the business of the Kshatriyas is to give protection to humanity, and the business of the Vaishyas, outside of giving protection, outside of performing agriculture, is to give protection to the cows. So the Kshatriyas have to make sure that people are performing their duties properly. That's the main business of a Kshatriya, an administrator. He has to just see to it that everyone in society is performing their duties properly and responsibly. In fact, Kshatriyas would be responsible for these big yagyas that would take place. The Kshatriyas would be responsible for assembling everyone for these yagyas. And outside of that being a proper method of performing yagya and so on for the upkeep of the society, another reason for those yagyas was to actually test the proficiency of brahmanas to see if they were performing their duties properly. So they will come and perform these elaborate yagyas, and many of them, the animal sacrifices will be going on, and the animals would be revived to life by various mantras and so on. So then in order to make sure that that was actually happening properly, the Kshatriyas would have these elaborate yagyas to see if the brahmanas were properly situated and their particular prescribed duties. They were properly able to perform these ceremonies, properly recite the mantras and so on. So that's why the point is that the Kshatriya's duty is to see to it that everyone's performing their responsibilities according to their nature. and according to their prescribed duty. That's the point. And if they neglect that, then of course havoc ensues out of that negligence. So here, the Vaishyas have a very important duty for maintaining living entities in the society also. They're responsible for agriculture, they're responsible for cow protection. Because there was no king to see to that responsibility was not taken. As a result, so many useless trees came up, no room for agriculture, and all the living entities had to suffer because of that. So this is where the story is taking up. Anyone wants to address anything here? Yeah.
Is the world already populated at this point of time, or are there no human beings other than...
No, there are living entities, humans also. There are humans there also, but it's more population is required. We're going to hear about that in a few verses, how Daksha, he populates humanity and a few other living entities, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't sufficient. I guess there's a lot of jivas that need to get the fruits of their fruit of activities, their karma. So it wasn't sufficient. We'll hear about that.
The father of Prachetas, Prachina Bharani,
yeah,
as you said, he has abandoned all his duties and left for his self-realization.
Yes. This comes up quite a bit in the Bhagavatam.
How does it apply to the current generation?
What do you mean, how does it apply to the current generation? Should we abandon everything and join the ashrams and cultivate Krishna consciousness? You're asking a brahmachari, so you know what I'm going to say. Of course, you know, if you want to give a more balanced answer, you know, we should give balanced answers. It depends on individuals. Nothing is the absolute path for everyone, per se. A lot of it does depend on individuals, where they're at in their own psychology. Because sometimes someone can abandon things externally, but internally be very attached to them and meditating upon them. So what Krishna refers to such an individual as a pretender. And he says far, far superior is the person who engages in karma yoga. You know, he recognizes his various attachments, but he's trying to perfect self-realization. So he works with a view of becoming self-realized. And so because of various people's psychological dispositions, their various attachments and so on, one method is not a cookie cutter for everyone. So therefore, in other words, there is generally required some sort of guidance. Prabhupada mentions in 241, someone who knows the nature of the individual so that he can get properly directed how he might go about self-realization with his particular type of psychology. If he's too attached, he's going to need another program that's going to help him become progressive. But the context and a lot of the context where these individuals are abandoning their duties seemingly all of a sudden comes, the general context comes in like a, almost like an ultimatum situation. And the earlier on in the same canto, fourth canto, we hear of Maharaj, what was his name? The father of Vena. What was the father of Vena's name? Angi, not Nabi, King. Yeah, Maharaj Anga, I think his name was. He was a father of Vena. He was also a very responsible king. His wife was the daughter of death. I don't know if that's Yamaraj, but the daughter of death. And so together they had this really useless son, Vena. He was like really useless. And Maharaj Anga tried to be, play the responsible card and try to take care of the family, tried to raise Vena to be nicely, but Vena was very cruel. He would play games with his friends, and when he would lose, he would kill his friends. So that's pretty messed up. You know, you can imagine having a friend like that. You want to play? Nah. I'll pass. So he tried to train Vena. He was not trainable. So finally, one night, after trying to fulfill his responsibility, after trying to fulfill his responsibilities as a responsible king, he saw that it was actually becoming an impediment to self-realization. So he finally decided one night, and he's described in that section as a Mahajan, actually a great soul. The language is used like that to describe him. And he finally decided that this was a great impediment to self-realization, which is the actual purpose of life in any of the ashrams. And because this was impeding self-realization, he made a decision to leave in the middle of the night. Leaving his wife, leaving his son, leaving the kingdom. And of course, as a result of that, Maharaj, King Vaina became the king later on. And of course, that led to a lot of problems and so on. So my point is that there was like an ultimatum. You know, this is an impediment to my spiritual development, which is the most important thing. You know, taking care of family is not the most important thing. It's important in terms of developing mode of goodness. It's important in terms of it helps our psychology move towards spiritual life. But then that's still on the relative platform. Taking care of family, performing work, and all these things are still on the relative platform, although they may be useful for helping us move towards the absolute truth. Oftentimes they are. But when there's a clash between the absolute and the relative platform, then the relative platform has to be left aside and the absolute taken up. So great souls, they're able to easily discern that, because they're all very trained individuals also. Many of us don't have that sort of spiritual training. So sometimes there's a little bit of difficulty, we just want to abandon things, but we're not actually psychologically detached from those things, and it leads to problems. These persons were sufficiently advanced in terms of their knowledge and detachment, but they were performing their duties responsibly for setting an example for the rest of society. But then when there was a clash between their absolute interests of self-realization and the relative interest of setting an example for society by taking up these responsibilities, they left the relative position aside and took up the absolute necessity of spiritual life. Again, they were able to make that discernment because of their own advancement in self-realization. Many of us may not yet be so mature to discern that. Therefore, we have guiding, not that we don't need guidance when we become advanced, but we do have guiding lights, the shastras, particularly gurus and sadhus, to help us come to such conclusions. Similarly, in the case of Prachina Bharhi, after hearing from Narada Muni, for him it was like, okay, here's my absolute necessity in terms of self-realization and getting free from the sinful reactions that I have accrued from my yajnas, and here's the relative interest of taking care of the society and setting up the example, which is an important one, but still a relative interest. And he came to the conclusion after hearing from Narada Muni that the absolute necessity has to be taken up immediately. It cannot wait. And so he made a decision. So again, as an operative principle, we may need guidance for us because we're not so mature. But these personalities were very advanced, and they can understand that when there's a clash between the absolute necessity and the relative consideration needs to be left aside and the absolute taken up. Generally, we feel uncomfortable with making this sort of point in a public arena because people are generally irresponsible. So we tend to want to, we don't usually highlight the absolute necessity side because people will take that message wrongly and just abandon their responsibilities out of frustration in the name of spiritual life. Prabhupada speaks about that in the first purport of chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita. And so we tend to not want to highlight on that point, and we highlight more on the point of becoming a responsible individual in society, gradually improving your psychology by becoming detached due to the influence of knowledge, and that way taking what you might call like a middle path toward in spiritual life. So that's an important message. But I like to also highlight the other side of the message, that when there's a clash between absolute necessity and a relative position, then sometimes the relative position has to be left aside. Like for example, in certain cases, people have jobs that take up all their life, that they have hardly any time for sadhana. They hardly have time for chanting their rounds or finishing their rounds at midnight or 10 o'clock in the evening, right before they hit the pillow. The last round is chanting in the bed only, waiting to hit the pillow. And when you ask them, are they hearing Bhagavatam? Are they able to hear classes? Are they able to chant properly? What's their sadhana? All they have time for is just work and eating prasadam, of course, That is never missed. And then a little bit of sadhana in the form of chanting holy name. So then that might be a situation where one has to come, well, what is the absolute necessity of life? Because working and all these things are meant to be auxiliary. They're meant to be supportive for our actual purpose in life as human beings, which is self-realization. So you're in a situation where work is taking up all your time, where you don't have time for sadhana, you don't have time for hardly associating with devotees properly outside of the context of the Sunday feast, and you have no time for study, the shot hearing, then you may have to make an adjustment, take up a simpler position where work is very meager, you only have to work a few hours, so you can give time for the real important issue in life, which is self-realization. After all, death may come at any moment, and we don't want to be absorbed in material affairs at the time of death, and so on. So it is important to understand what is the real purpose of human form of life. And these great personalities, they have understood that. So they made drastic decisions, or at least what we may consider to be drastic, and from a very moral perspective, somewhat irresponsible. I mean, like a king, they're the emperor of the whole planet. You know, and that's like major management that needs to go on. And they're just like, Hare Krishna. and they walk off, you know. And so from a strictly like moral, it's kind of irresponsible. And then as a result, there are consequences of that also. And yet, they achieve the goal of life. And they go back to the spiritual world. And so that message is a very prominent one in the Bhagavatam especially. It comes up quite a bit. Again, like I said, because that tendency is to misunderstand that message, we generally tend to, in the public arena, to emphasize on the other responsible life. But the thing about emphasizing that is that people misunderstand it also. That's the one thing. Just as they misunderstand the absolute message, they also misunderstand the relative position as well. It is not that by speaking that side, they've properly understood that either. Usually because people are already attached to work. That's what it means to be a conditioned soul. They're already attached to work. When you emphasize that side, they just go on with their attachment also. It's not broken. And then they don't take up the actual serious consideration of the human form of life. And they do so in the name of progressive spiritual life. Just as Krishna speaks about this in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 3, verse 34, where he says about regulating attachment and aversion. And because but that regulation you should not become attached to either, because that will become a stumbling block in self-realization as well. So in this way, at least by what I'm saying now, you should get this understanding. It's very hard to understand what to do. Understand? By what I'm speaking now, this conclusion should come up. And it becomes easier when we have guiding lights in our life, guru, sadhu, they can help us come to greater clarity about what to direction we should take. If you have to decide on your own, you'll never come to any conclusion, because you'll find support for either side of the issue. And and even after you accept a path given by guru, you may not always feel confident in your movement there. You may notice that, you know, either the guru says join the brahmacharya ashram, but you're still thinking, oh, grihastha would be better for me, and so on. Or you go to the grihastha side, anything, but now I'm absorbed in work and I should have just been a brahmachari. Many times, even after you find map out a path, it's hard to be confident unless you have really staunch faith in a guru and their guidance for you. But this is an important principle to keep in mind. When there's a clash between the absolute and the relative, normally they work like parallel tracks, but if there should be some clash between the two, then the relative should be left aside and the absolute taken up. And that will come up in our life. You want to say something to this? Yep. Yes, I'll cover one more verse. Is there to be covered here?
Hare Krishna. In this discussion, you were just mentioning the two sides. I was thinking of that verse in the fifth chapter of the first canto. Narad Muni, it's like Chaktva. You know that one?
Yeah.
That if one should prematurely renounce and pursue a higher level of devotional involvement than he's actually prepared to take up. There's no loss because that engagement is a purification that has eternal benefit. So would it be safe to say we should always err on the side of renunciation or not material renunciation, but error on the side of increased devotional involvement? Is that a correct assumption?
Well, I think I answered it by saying we should err on the side of following whatever guru says to us. Because it's not like we have to make a decision on our own. At least at this, it's not that we're bereft of higher level of sangha either. At least we take it for granted that our guru is higher level of sangha. Otherwise, how you make progress if you don't take it that way? So given that our guru is higher level of sangha, there's no reason to err on either side, really, because the guru is giving chalking out a particular path. And then disciple means he will be having confidence in that particular guiding direction for him. So there's not like we're alone trying to come to a conclusion. And so, of course, Narada Muni quotes that verse to glorify the preeminence of bhakti and those who take shelter of bhakti. There's really no loss, which is certainly true, but it could lead to other sorts of spiritual obstacles like duplicity and so on. And these sorts of obstacles start to come up, duplicity, pratishta. And although, so he's saying if you abandon your duties, there is no loss because you won't get any sinful reactions because you've taken bhakti, shelter. But it could lead to other sorts of spiritual diseases also, like duplicity and pratishta, etc. So an advanced Vaishnava may, seeing a certain individual attached in a certain sort of way, give another prescription. As is the case with Narada Muni, who gave a prescription for Dhruva Maharaj in one way. He had to deal with King Prachinda Barishat in another way. He dealt with the Haryashras and this canto's coming up in another way. He dealt with Vyasa in another way. So Guru, given we have that confidence, he has that insight. And he may give a certain direction, not because he's interested in material affairs, but because he's worried about the spiritual obstacles that will come up in a disciple who falsely renounces his position. You may think, nah, I'm very great, I'm very advanced like that, and then he's finished. Spiritual obstacle is there. And so then Guru may give another direction. Better you work, be humble, and see all these renounced Vaishnavas much more advanced than you. Because you're thinking to be renounced is an advanced position. So the Guru says, you go on working. So that way you always feel that you're lower than these people at least. And that way he might protect you from a spiritual disease. Yeah, you want to follow up or something?
Yeah, just a quick response. I've been hearing recently a dramatic reading of the Bhagavad Gita, and so a disciple of Prabhupada, Purnachandra Maharaj, he includes his little explanation to help the listener understand how the flow of the Bhagavad Gita is happening. So he comments that, like you're saying, if one takes a position of renunciation, or like sannyas is the example in the Gita, prematurely and should fall down, it's a very awkward position because work is the means by which he would be purified of that anartha that led him to fall down from his position of renunciation. But having entered the sannyas ashram, or the renounced position, he's supposed to have given up work. So then it's a very awkward position because the medicine he's supposed to take is something he's already supposed
to
take.
This is what, chapter 3?
I think so.
Yeah, of course, that's an ordinary varnashram context. With bhakti, is not as awkward because you can just start chanting again. And, okay, so you fell down from sannyas, you know, but your opportunity for pure devotional service hasn't been lost even in the slightest. You're just going chanting now. With everyone looking at you like you fell down, and now you have to be really Trinadapi, really humble. Everyone thinks you're just a fallen person, and that's really good for your bhajan. And you go on cultivating your bhajan from there. It's not that your bhakti is destroyed by these things. If you do some sin, like fall down from sannyas position, bhakti isn't touched by that. We already discussed that in chapter 2. The seed of bhakti cannot be harmed by anything material. So even if someone falls down and on account of some sinful activity, his bhakti is not hurt by that. Bhakti can be hurt only by offenses. His ego is hurt by that. That false ego is definitely pained greatly by such a fall. That's embarrassing. And he may have caused some harm in society as well. But bhakti is actually not harmed by that. So he only need now continue his bhakti. But now he would have to do so in a very humble position, which is also useful for his bhajan. So he carries on. But so the example you gave is in an ordinary sense minus bhakti. That's my point. Any other? So I'm going to move on to the next verse. And the next verse, yeah, just the next verse, I think. And then after that, Soma comes to offer prayers to pacify them. So we'll move on. So next verse, 5. Drimebhya krudyamanaste tapo dipitamanyava. Mukato bhayam agnim cha sasri justa didhakshaya. Because of having undergone long austerities in the water, the Prachetas were very angry at the trees. Desiring to burn them to ashes, they generated wind and fire from their mouths. Yes. Purport. Here the word tapo dipita manyava indicates that persons who have undergone severe austerity, tapasya, are endowed with great mystic power as evinced by the Prachetas, who created fire and wind from their mouths. Although devotees undergo severe tapasya, however, they are vimanyava sadavaha, which means that they are never angry. They are always decorated with good qualities. Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, chapter 25, verse 21 states, Tatikshava kanunika surida sarvadehinam ajata shatrava shanta sadava sadubhushanaha. A sadhu, a devotee, is never angry. Actually, the real feature of devotees who undergo tapasya, austerity, is forgiveness. Although a Vaishnava has sufficient power in tapasya, he does not become angry when put into difficulty. If one undergoes tapasya, but does not become a Vaishnava, however, one does not develop good qualities. For example, Hiranyakashipu and Ravana also performed great austerities, but they did not so to demonstrate their demoniac tendencies. Vaishnavas must meet many opponents while preaching the glories of the Lord, but Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommends that they not become angry while preaching. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given this formula, Chinada Pisunichena, Torora Pisahishnuna, Amanina Amanadena, Kirtaniya Sadahri, quote, one should chant the holy name of the Lord in a humble state of mind, thinking oneself lower than the straw on the street. One should be more tolerant than a tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige, and should be ready to offer all respect to others. In such a state of mind, one can chant the holy name of the Lord constantly. End quote. Those engaged in preaching the glories of the Lord should be humbler than grass and more tolerant than a tree. Then they can preach the glories of the Lord without difficulty. So the Prachetas come out of the water, having been sent there by their father. They were there for 10,000 years. They've pleased the Supreme Lord. They've come out of the water to now accept their responsibility as king. They see the earth is covered with trees, and they become excessively angry, actually. And the reason for their anger is described here, tapo dipita manyava. Due to the influence of their austerity, their anger is inflamed. And so, because they were mystic yogis, as you would expect, they were underneath water for 10,000 years. So they must be pretty powerful yogis. So out of their power, they begin to generate fire from their eyes. And then they're going to burn all the trees to the ground. And the reason for doing so is due to the excessive anger that has come on account of their austerity. So Prabhupada is bringing up that point, that due to austerity, for one who is not a devotee, has opposite effect. Austerity is meant to actually, austerity means voluntarily accepting some suffering for some higher purpose. That's called austerity. Voluntarily accepting some suffering for a higher purpose. This is the meaning of austerity. So, but that higher purpose really depends on who you're asking what the higher purpose is. So like Prabhupada's giving the example of Hiranyakashipu and Ravana, their higher purpose was conquer the whole universe. So they accepted a very severe austerity. In fact, in the case of Hiranyakashipu, his austerity was unmatched by any sadhus even, before his time and in the future also. Lord Brahma said no one will be able to perform such an austerity. But the result of his austerity was an attempt to subjugate the universe. Actually, he was quite successful in subjugating the universe. So Prabhupada's pointing out that this type of austerity, devoid of Krishna consciousness, does not generate good qualities. It has the opposite effect. This statement comes in the fourth canto also. God, I don't remember it. It's in the Prithumaraj pastime. Anyway, a long list of qualities are given by Prithumaraj, and then he makes a point that all these qualities have the opposite effect for persons who are not devotees of the Lord. So to be knowledge, to be wealthy, etc., these various opulences, from one who is not a devotee of the Lord, has the effect of degrading people's consciousness. They develop all bad qualities on account of these good opulences of the Lord. They become proud, they become degraded. So only in the case of a devotee is austerity considered an actual ornament. In the case of those who are not devotees, it's not an ornament. It is the cause of their degradation. Prabhupada will later on say, I think in the seventh chapter of this canto, that opulences, it is a fact for anyone under the influence of the most material nature, opulence is the source of degradation. He said, and then Prabhupada says this is a law of nature. It is a law of nature that anyone who has opulences will become degraded. So only a person who has Krishna consciousness do these particular sorts of qualities and ornaments really become ornaments. Otherwise, they become sources of degradation. So in the case of a devotee, Prabhupada is saying that they also will perform tapasya, but their tapasya is always for achieving Krishna. In fact, in the second canto, Krishna says, that austerity which is meant for achieving me is me. That austerity which is meant for achieving me is me. And especially in the context of, this is an aside point, but the case in the context of Raghunuga Bhakti and Vishnachavara Thakur's Raghavatam Chandrika, he speaks about austerity being an important element for a devotee moving towards the attainment of Braj Bhakti. He actually mentions this. And the case example given are the Shrutis. The Shrutis who also perform tapasya, he quotes one verse, in order to attain Krishna and Braja. So austerity that is meant to attain Krishna, that austerity is Krishna, because it will lead you to Krishna. So the devotees, they have, their austerity doesn't degrade them because of their intent to achieve Krishna. There's another point that I'm trying to make that I'm losing here. Anyway, I'm losing one point that I'm trying to make. Final point is there, Prabhupada is indicating what is that tapasya for a devotee. So he quotes the verse, Trinada Pisuni Chena, Tori Ivasahi Shuna. The austerity for a devotee is to become more humble than a blade of grass, more tolerant than a tree, to give respect to all others and not respect any in return. In fact, if you think of applying this verse, you can understand that it is an austerity. In fact, when you hear this verse, you may lose inspiration on account of how I ever achieved Krishna consciousness. So this is a tapasya of a devotee. I remember the point now. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami points out how vairagya and jnana and other such things such as tapasya could be helpful in the beginning. But the tendency of these processes is to make the heart very hard. That's the tendency of these processes. When one practices vairagya, practices austerity, outside of the context of achieving the lotus feet of Krishna, the tendency is to make the heart very hard and callous. And so therefore, he says, because bhakti anyway gives all these ornaments as a corollary, then the devotee just accepts bhakti because bhakti has a way of giving these things and keeping the heart simultaneously soft. Whereas if you try to follow these processes of austerity and so on outside the context of bhakti, it tends to make the heart callous. And a callous heart is not useful for bhakti. And so therefore, it is very important that one takes shelter of bhakti in order that one can also gain these qualities, but they become ornaments that decorate the devotee's character. Otherwise, his heart becomes callous. He cannot attain Krishna. So What is the austerity? Prabhupada's bringing out in the purport, particularly for devotee, and the austerity is to become more humble than a blade of grass, etc. Lord Chaitanya has preached this. This is the austerity for devotees, and very difficult austerity to practice as well. Otherwise, this austerity you don't practice, then these other qualities come and take over and degrade the consciousness. This point being mentioned.
In Kali Yuga, wouldn't it be a stretch to maintain that austerity? Like, for instance, if you're out on Sankirtan, if someone picks up a rock and tries to throw it at you like Lord Nityananda, it's like, and it hits you and you see bleeding, it's going to be kind of difficult for you to maintain that soberness in mind, you know. And even if you say you want to be as humble and tolerant, that austerity will be a stretch.
It is a stretch if you're not so developed. So we all have to improve our consciousness. Yeah, we're not saying that you should imitate, but one has to progressively try to achieve these higher levels of consciousness. This verse, Trinada Peace Vinichana, is within the realm of practice. So it's not like only the perfected souls have these qualities. This particular verse, the Shishashakam is presenting a series of verses from practice to perfection. And the discussion of Trinada Peace Vinichana comes within the context of a spiritual practice, not a spiritual perfection. And so, in other words, it has to be an element of our practice, coming to the extent that someone does throw a rock at you, it hits your head, you start bleeding, and you can tolerate that. Now, if it happens to another devotee, it might be, that's a different scenario. You might not be as tolerant. Like in the case of Mahaprabhu, Nityananda was tolerant, but Mahaprabhu was ready to chop heads. And he was going to chop heads also, until Nityananda Prabhu told him, this is not the purpose of your lila. As Krishna, you chop heads. But as Lord Chaitanya, you give mercy. Everyone in Kali Yuga is like them only. So no chopping heads in this lila. And Lord Chaitanya, due to the mercy of Nityananda, did not chop heads. Otherwise, we should come to the point in our practice where that could happen to us potentially, and we could tolerate it. It won't disturb us. It's a spiritual practice. Of course, it's a higher level of practice, but it's a practice nonetheless. So we have to improve. The only reason that comes up is because we have big false egos. We think, how could they do this to me? They're not actually not touching you. Only the body is getting marked up. It's just like if someone keys your car. It happened to me one time when I went to the Krishna house, and when I parked into this tiny space, I was like right against the car of this other person, so it was hard for him to get out. And so the next morning, when I went to the car, it was like 4 in the morning, there was a note on the window still. And in the note, he said, using many bad words, he said, you lucky I didn't key your car, you know, and just take a key. And you know what the word key your car is, right? Take a key and just, he said, you, and then he, using very bad language, he was really upset about that. But he didn't do it, so I was very grateful. he was Trinada Pisunichana. Well, not so much, but Torori Vasa Hishana, at least he didn't key the car. And so, anyway, what point was I making? The point is that you should come to the point, the reason that we get upset is because of false ego. So just like if someone were to key the car, then you get upset. Nothing's actually happened to you. But because you're so closely identified with your car, if someone keys your car, you become very furious about it. Although that has nothing to do with you whatsoever. So similarly, someone throws a rock at your head and the head starts bleeding. That has nothing to do with you. You've not actually been touched whatsoever. The only reason you become frustrated about that is because of false ego. That makes you say that you are this body. And therefore, they've actually harmed you. In fact, this becomes a major theme of the 7th canto, 1st chapter. That that when the Supreme Lord is blasphemed by individuals, that because they're conditioned souls, they have no way of perceiving spiritual. So even when they blaspheme the Lord, he has no concept of that. Because you can only have a concept of violence being done to you if you have a false ego. But if you have no false ego, then you can have no concept of violence also. You understand? Violence can only come up in the context of a false ego. Of course, anyway, we're just keeping it on this particular point. You can nuance the discussion a little bit. So this idea is that someone has done violence to me only comes up in the context of a false ego. If you have no false ego, then there can be no perception of violence also. even if someone throws a rock toward you. So then, at least understanding this in principle, we'd not be able to apply it. We should understand that my frustration is due to the influence of false ego, and not because that person's actually done anything wrong. You understand? Especially philosophically speaking, I probably deserve that. I probably deserve it as a manifestation of the reaction of my karma. So if I'm getting frustrated, my frustration is simply due to big false ego. Therefore, the need to practice Shunyata Pisunin Chena. Not that this is easy, but it is a practice and a lesson that has to come up.
So just to clarify, the reason why... Excuse me. So austerity is performed by the non-devotees. It gives them qualities which you called opulences, and that makes them proud. That's why... That's the problem for the non... Yes? So... excuse me, I have allergies. What Krishna says in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, all these performers who know the meaning of sacrifice become cleansed of sinful reactions, and having tasted the nectar of the results of sacrifices, they advance towards the supreme eternal atmosphere. And this is after he's already described various kinds of performers of austerities, like kind of like the Prachetas. So how do we understand that although they were performing austerities, according to this statement, they should be getting cleansed and heading towards Brahma?
Well, in those types of statements, the main factor is the motivation behind the action. What makes the difference between karma yoga and karma kanda is the motivation behind it. A karma yogi and a karma kandi both perform their prescribed duties, but they get a different result because they have a different motivation behind the performance of the action. The karma kandi wants to enjoy the fruits of the action for himself, and so he continues in samsara. The karma yogi wants to attain self-realization, and so he goes off to do so. So in these types of contexts, motivation becomes the important, or the ingredient that needs to be recognized. Without that ingredient, then these sorts of things lead to degradation. So in the case of Hirani Kashipu, that ingredient wasn't there, so it led to degradation. In the case of devotees, that ingredient is there, so it doesn't lead to degradation.
It seems that Prachetas also had a devotional mentality because they pleased Lord Shiva, they pleased the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Sure.
It's hard for me to understand how they weren't getting cleansed of these, how they got proud of their opulences, because it seems like they had a devotional mentality.
Well, perhaps Bhagavatam's trying to highlight certain points, at least the acharyas highlight certain points for us. And it's not that if you're a devotee that these things don't come up. Dhruva Maharaj became excessively angry also, and Swayambhu Vamanu had to come down and preach to him. So it's not that in the case of a devotee, these things won't come up. They come up. But the difference between a devotee and a non-devotee is that a devotee can easily correct himself. Oh, of course, with the assistance of others. He easily corrects the action, as did Dhruva Maharaj, as will the Prachetas after hearing from Soma, King Soma. So it's not like, you know, it doesn't come up. It comes up. Yeah.
So it's kind of like Michael was bringing up this to me in 2.7 Bhagavad Gita yesterday. Prabhupada tells Arjuna, says that Arjuna is fully sense-controlled, although he's quote-unquote bewildered by the situation. So it's kind of like that, that fundamentally the devotee has all the good qualities, is fully sense-controlled, although by the situation he may become a little bit bewildered or confused.
The main good quality of a devotee is he's surrendered to Krishna. So even if the other good qualities aren't manifesting, it doesn't really matter. The other qualities are tathastha lakshana. That means they only help to glorify the devotee's surrender or help bring further light to the devotee's surrender. But that surrender stands on its own. Just like the example I like to give is a lake. The way you understand a lake from other bodies of water is that a lake is surrounded by land. That's how. So the land helps to clarify what a lake is, but the lake itself is essence, so to speak, is liquidity. So the lake exists on its own, is self-evident in one sense, but the lake helps to clarify that. But with or without the land, the water still has its own self-evident nature. So similarly, surrender has its own self-evident nature, and these qualities are only helping to highlight that point. But with or without those qualities, the devotee's surrender stands on its own. So therefore, I think sometimes we take like verses such as Yasyasi Bhaktir Bhagavati Kinchana, that the devotee of the Lord has all the good qualities of the devas and demigods and so on. And sometimes that we, like I said, with most things, when we come to spiritual life, our understanding of these qualities needs redefinition. Because what compassion meant as a non-devotee isn't exactly the proper understanding of what it means in a devotional context. And particularly when it comes to the point that these qualities are just really secondary to surrender. And this comes up quite a bit in the Bhagavatam's message, especially many places actually comes up, I can think of right off the top of my head. So surrender has its own self-evident quality, and these other qualities just help to glorify that. So their main good quality, in the cases where they seem to exhibit bad qualities and so on, but they have this main good quality, which is surrender. In one sense, that's enough. And as a result of that quality, Krishna corrects them. He makes an arrangement for them and so on. And there's also the idea that these are just pastimes. They help to educate conditioned souls like us and so on. So there's that element there as well. But the main good quality is that they're surrendered to Krishna. If you had to live with a person who is super humble or a person who is prideless, let's think of these qualities from the Bhagavad Gita, someone who's super humble, prideless, what are some of the other qualities mentioned there? Tolerant, simple. So you have that type of person on the one side, but they don't have any devotion to Krishna. But they are really humble individuals in terms of externally. So they're simple, they're tolerant. And you have another person over here who has all bad qualities, apparently, but he has devotion to Krishna. He's only taking shelter of Krishna. Then what type of society do you want to live in? Which society do you want? Would you like the person with the simple qualities, humble, all these things, or the person who's got devotion to Krishna? Yeah, philosophically, we prefer the devotional one. Psychologically, come back to me. My point is that they may or may not come up. You may or may not always see them. That's the exact point that I'm making. So, yeah, you may not perceive them. It means they may not come up also. This point, this verse, there's a verse in the 11th canto, chapter 11, verse number 30 through 34. 30, 31, 32, 30, yeah, 30 through 34. So the first three is five verses. The first three verses gives a long list of qualities of bhakta. One of them means surrender. And he has, like, one of them, when you hear these qualities, you think this is the pure devotee. I think I read this verse to you only. And this is considered the lowest level of devotee. Then a higher level than that particular devotee is one who is also surrendered, like this devotee, but he doesn't manifest all these qualities. He just surrendered, he just does bhakti, hearing, chanting, remembering, and so on, but he doesn't manifest all these qualities. Then there's another devotee who's like, he has knowledge, he doesn't have knowledge, he's just like lost in love for Krishna. So five levels of devotees three levels of devotees are mentioned in five verses. So my point is that those qualities may not always be perceptible. So in the beginning of devotional service, the first three verses speak about devotion that's mixed with karma. So and when there's devotion mixed with karma, the emphasis is on qualities. And because most of us, being newcomers, our bhakti is mixed with karma, so that's the message that we mostly hear emphasized. So you have to have good qualities. And the devotee, such a devotee will give a lot of weight to those qualities in his devotion. So he has surrender to Krishna also, but he also gives weight to manifesting these sorts of qualities. Therefore, his bhakti is called Karma Mishra. Bhakti, this is what Jiva Goswami says about it. He will give weight to that in his consciousness. Whereas the second tier devotee, he also sees the benefit of such qualities and the consequences of not having those qualities, but not caring either way, he just chants Hare Krishna. So his surrender is considered of a higher quality, and that he just takes shelter of Krishna. He doesn't give any weight to those qualities in his consciousness. And he will also be manifesting these qualities also naturally, but he doesn't give weight to them in his consciousness. He just gives weight to hearing, chanting, surrender like this. Then another devotee who's just lost in another realm of consciousness, so it's a little bit hard to understand. I've not understood that verse so much. So my point is that for us, this emphasis is good because our bhakti is mixed. And therefore, we need to manifest qualities, otherwise there's just a lot of degradation. And also, we live in a society context. If you don't make such emphasis, then there could be problems within the community. So such emphasis shall be there. But the main quality of a devotee is to surrender, and that can stand on its own, with or without those other qualities being manifest whatsoever. And that's the point I'm making.
So, Prabhu, quick clarification. So, Rupa Goswami in NOI, the quality of Utsaha, Nisya, Dharyat, determination, they are karma mishra qualities?
No, that's a different context. He's speaking about things that are useful for bhajan. The first few verses of NOI deal with shared nagati. What is useful for bhajan, what is not useful for bhajan.
For surrenderance, this quality they require them, because without this quality, bhajan will not happen.
So we have to. We can come back to that in more. That's not. The surrender is accepting what is favorable for his Krishna consciousness. So all those qualities can be favorable for a certain individual, as they are in the case of the Karma Mishra Bhakta, as I've already mentioned. And a certain individual, he won't give any weight to that. That won't be a concern. Because he's just focused on his bhajan. That comes up. That happens. Some individuals focus on their bhajan, so they won't give weight to all these other sorts of points. And it's not and in fact, that's favorable for their bhajan, for their focus and concentration. So what is favorable for one at a certain stage of development may not be favorable for another in another stage of development. Understand? So in our stage of development, these things are important. So I have said that point already. I'll say it again just so I don't get in trouble. But that at our stage, these qualities are important. For one reason, for our relationships, they're required. Otherwise, it could be a lot of problems without them. And also because as conditioned souls, we're attached to piety and sin. And so therefore, the message of piety it has to be given. Because we're already attached to piety and sin, we'll oscillate between the two. So then by giving the emphasis on the qualities, you help to give people movement towards the mode of goodness, which is useful for their development. So therefore, we do emphasize these things. But I am making another point as well, that Sharanagati can stand on its own without the manifesting of all these sorts of qualities alone. Whether or not that should be said in the public arena, that's up for opinion, but I said it anyway. Something else? I'll take one more question.
Then you may choose not to discuss this because it's further on this point. I was just thinking the mode of goodness that you're saying that it's useful. Sometimes there may be too much focus on that and we may neglect the aspect of developing surrender. So, I mean, how?
Yeah, I've already covered that message in my earlier discussion, that when there's a clash between the absolute and the relative, the absolute, and so I made the point that oftentimes when you take an absolute position on things, that is misunderstood. But it's also true when you take a relative position on things, that is also misunderstood. So you may say, emphasize, just drop everything and surrender to Krishna. And people are frustrated with their duty, so they drop everything because they're irresponsible and they take shelter of Krishna. So that's a misunderstanding. But then on the other side, you say you got to perform your duties responsibly and progressively, make advancement towards Krishna. And they misunderstand that by being completely absorbed in work, and this is part of the progressive movement towards Krishna. So it happens on either side. So therefore, manusha nam surasheshu kashayati, you know, very rare anyone actually becomes Krishna conscious. It's very hard to understand. I was mentioning this yesterday, that language is a little bit interesting. I've been reading about this recently, and I got an insight to why Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says that the Shastra has two faces. He says one face is the deluding face, and the other face is the transcendental face. And there's a reason for this, actually, because language is a little bit bewildering. You have basically three things. You have the object itself, like a kartal. You have the object, then you have the word that refers to the object, and then you have the imprint in your mind that comes up when you hear the word kartal. Right, so there's three things going on. The actual object, the word that refers to it, and then the imprint in your mind when you hear that word. So we, as conditioned souls, we only have immediate access to the imprint in our mind. We don't really have understanding what the actual object is. Like, it looks like something to us, but really what it is the amalgamation of the various elements of material nature. You know, as is this whole world. So we think when you amalgamate the elements in a particular way, it looks like something that bewilders us, right? But when you, if you separate those elements, it's not so bewildering, right? Just like if you take a car, when you see a nice car, put assembled or a cake. When you see the cake assembled, it's very attractive, right? But when you see the cake in a mixing bowl, you don't get as attracted, right? Because it's, all the ingredients are unassembled. So that's exactly what the discussion of Sankhya will do. It will disassemble all the elements in our mind so that the material nature isn't as alluring. You understand? So anyway, the point I'm making is that we don't actually have direct understanding what the object really is. We only have the immediate access to the imprints in our mind. So when we hear language, when we hear certain words used, we don't actually have direct access to what is being said. We only have direct access to the impressions of what we think is being said. And that way we become deluded. So when we so therefore Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says the deluding face is available to us. So we read the shastras, we read the words in the books, and all we're getting is the impressions of what these words mean to us, and not the actual meaning of the word. And only the Mahabhagavata devotee can perceive past that and see what is actually being indicated and true. And he tries to convey that to us, but we often misunderstand. So spiritual life requires a lot of mercy. So I already covered your point. Spiritual life requires a lot of mercy. That yes, we may overemphasize this point. We may overemphasize this point. Therefore, you try to give a balanced discussion. And even in your attempt to give a balanced discussion, people still misunderstand. We still misunderstand it. And we give the wrong emphasis in our heart and on. So spiritual life, in this way, we should understand that progress is coming by a lot of mercy. We're progressing in spite of us. Understand? Not because of my sadhana and I'm making good progress. In spite of us, some progress is going on. This is because of Lord Chaitanya's mercy, Srila Prabhupada's mercy, that in spite of us, some movement is still happening. Otherwise, it's very challenging.
To maybe the question for the elaboration on a specific aspect, just when we were discussing Ishopanishad, that we should all take some initiative to go deeper and to take the process more seriously. So I was thinking, how can we motivate ourselves or inspire ourselves to take that initiative to focus more on the surrender aspect and develop more surrender and not just be caught up in the regulated activities of maybe staying in the ashram that follow a very regulated lifestyle, and we may think that we are making progress that way.
I wonder how many devotees in the ashram would consider themselves very regulated. Show of hands, who here in the ashram considers themselves very regulated?
I mean, at least that's the role model, or at least that's the ideal, that you should be regulated.
The reason I say that, so I have a show of zero hands. So the reason I say that is because oftentimes we are not very regulated. We come to the morning programs and so on. We do the stipulated programs, but we're not, usually many of us are not very regulated. And so like I was mentioning to Chinpoint the other day, because of the lack of mode of goodness, our determination is weak. Determination becomes strong because of the influence of sattva-guna. So because many of us are passionate, rajaguna is still very prominent. Unless there's sense gratification involved, we don't show much enthusiasm. And that's due to the influence of the rajaguna, right? If there's pizza downstairs, you know, everyone, you hear everyone running down the stairs like an army. But if it's just like ordinary rice-style kitchen and so on, everyone's showing up at their own pace and coming whenever they want and so on. You hear pizza and cake. So when there's rajaguna, there's determination to get sense gratification. And in tamaguna, you just don't care about anything. You just sit there and sleep and mope and lament and etc. So you need, in order to be intent upon spiritual life, you need an influence of the sattva-guna is important. So one can increase the sattva-guna. Otherwise, the other thing is that you somehow or other, one gets the association of some devotee who is able to touch your heart, and he says something that sticks. And because of that sticking to the heart, one's movement becomes very strong. But generally the case is there needs to be a practice that really increases sattva-guna in us. Otherwise, it's very hard to remain determined. The modes of nature are very powerful. So unless you, sattva-guna is useful for spiritual life. So unless that is increased, it's very hard to keep up pace in spiritual life. Rajaguna doesn't allow you to do so. Rajaguna tamaguna. Like that. So we need to influence the higher modes. Higher mode of nature. Okay then. Srila Prabhupada.